Welcome, this is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 20th of February, 2013, here in the land of the rising sun, but today we're joined from the sunny, wonderful, comfortable climes of Sao Paulo, Brazil, by our good friend Pepe Escobar of the Asia Times Online and many, many other publications besides. Pepe, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time tonight.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. No, this is not sunny. This is the southern hemisphere. It's very violent. People will mug you, people will kill you, and I'm barricaded at home talking to Japan.
Well, I hope nothing happens, at least during the course of the interview.
Maybe not.
Well, how is the weather there recently? Because I've heard there's a bit of a drought in Brazil right now that's worrying some people in the energy sector specifically.
Well, it depends on where you are, because this is like Russia, China, and India. This country is huge. I am in the southeast, Sao Paulo, the financial business capital of the country. We have no clue what's going on in the Amazon. And we have no clue what's going on in the northeast, which is a sort of a Sahara Sahel region in the hinterlands, right? The economy depends on who you're talking to. If you talk to government officials, they say, now it's fine, our fight is against inflation. So they are implying that what they were talking about until literally, what, 2 or 3 months ago, which was currency wars, is not currency wars anymore. They were worried about inflation in Brazil. They say the inflation in Brazil nowadays is around 6% a year. It's not. I went to the supermarket the other day. I did a few calculations. It's over 25%. Real inflation in terms of your pocketbook. So Brazil, like China and India and Russia, the BRICS are all in the same boat in terms of this new emerging middle class. So when I arrived from anywhere in the world to Sao Paulo's airport, which is more or less like arriving in Lagos in Nigeria, it's an absolutely horrific airport. You see this new middle class traveling for the first time in their lives, in fact, going to Miami, going to New York, etc. And they come back with 100 kilos of luggage each and spending a lot of dollars that they don't have abroad. So guess what this is doing to Brazil's finances as well. So they were even thinking about starting some sort of capital control in terms of how much money a Brazilian can spend abroad. Just like the Russians, the Brazilians, and the Chinese especially, they are among the ultra-large spenders anyway, especially in the U.S. and in Europe. So, you know, there are all these problems. If you talk to the middle class here, if you talk to the urban middle class in Sao Paulo, their number one preoccupation is security. And the fact that we are living, just like the U.S. until 2007, 2008, in a housing bubble. When the housing bubble bursts in Brazil, it could be the South American equivalent of what happened in the U.S., considering the fact that now millions of people are also, they bought houses that they don't have the money to pay for obvious reasons. They bought all sorts of plasma TVs and Mac computers that they also cannot pay. Even if they pay on installments, 20 months, 25 months, it's still impossible. So the miracle that Lula accomplished in his 8 years as president, which is to create a new emerging Brazilian middle class, now we have this middle class in action, and the results can be very complicated, just like in China, where the new middle class in China is not 30 million, it's 200 million. And then we have, okay, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, you're painting a vivid picture here, and Brazil is a land of contradictions and contrarians, but this is a bit too far, I think. I mean, as you point out, in a global currency war with a race to debase and the devaluation, you have the real stiffening in an attempt to curb inflation. It's now trading towards a higher band, upwards, flirting with 1.95 to the dollar. You have the world's sixth largest economy, and you have low unemployment, at least by the government figures, but you have this slowing down economy. You have last year, for example, 1% GDP growth. This year, predicting 3.2% growth.
Probably going to be 2, in fact.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be revised downward.
They're going to lower it. They're lowering it on a monthly basis.
There's all the jiggery pokery to do with inflation in the government statistics, as you point out. So what is really underlying this, and where do you think things are heading from here?
Look, two key points, I would say. First of all, Brazil cannot become... Now they're starting to dream for the first time in over 450 years of history that they're going to be the next great power in the future. Absolutely wrong. This is wishful thinking. I can be here. They say that I am a nihilistic entity, even worse than Nietzsche would ever dream of. But I try to be realistic about this country. I grew up here. I've been all over the world. I come back here once in a while, so I can always, I'm always able to compare Brazil to other emerging powers as well. Problem number one, infrastructure. They're going to host a World Cup next year and then the Olympics in 2016. And if you look at the preparations and the people who are in power, it's beyond frightening. It's not only the corruption cases, the fact that they are building stadiums that could even collapse during a match during the World Cup. It's the immense corruption and the pork that is being distributed to regional governments and municipalities all over the country. You know, that's number one. Number two, airports. Brazilian airports nowadays, they rank among the worst in the world, even though Brazilian national companies are now some of the most profitable in the world. Because, you know, with the emergence of this new middle class, everybody's traveling. There are new local airline companies. Seats are all full, but the security conditions are absolutely terrible. And number three, there's no investment in education in this country. Dilma, when she, in the beginning of her second term, she said that Brazil would devote 10% of GDP to invest in education. Now it's less than 6 in real terms, and it's not going to be more than 5 in a year or two. So if a country like this has no infrastructure, no formation of high-tech workers to, you know, in fact, compete globally, they cannot. They can compete locally or maybe in a Latin American sense, but they cannot compete globally. There's no investment in education. Plus all these imbalances of a real estate bubble, not only here in the richer part of the country, in the south, but all over the country. I think what is brewing in the midterm is the perfect storm. And it's not going to be as hardcore as in China, because in China, you have 3.2 trillion in reserves. You can have programs that are worth 700 billion or 800 billion imposed by the central government, and it works because it's imposed top-down. Here's different. It's a messy democracy. But what comes in the package of a messy democracy is a lot of corruption as well. And the priorities are all stacked usually the wrong way. Because to give you a small example in terms of inefficiency in management, the people who surround Dilma as president, which are basically people who are affiliated with the Workers' Party, they are very mediocre technicians, technocrats or bureaucrats or whatever, you know. Incredible as it might seem, not really incredible. When Cardoso was president, and Cardoso, he became a neoliberal in the 90s, but at least the people who were advising or part of his team, they were very competent technocrats. We don't have this in Brazil anymore, that these people are part of the opposition, or they forgot about it completely, or in fact, they gave up. They left the country. They are back in the U.S. or in Europe. So this is an enormous problem. It's obviously directly linked to absolutely appalling standards of education, from high school to the universities, which are, you know, I have a lot of people who are, they are at the University of São Paulo, which is still the best university in Brazil. They paint me a horrible picture of, you know, installations, the level of their students. It's not very dissimilar to the U.S., in fact, when you think about it. But it's very worrying because Brazil is still in an initial stage of development, right?
Exactly. And you bring up the comparison to some of the other developing economies, so-called, and obviously that brings up the idea of the BRICS, and Brazil being, yes, of course, the B in the BRICS, putting the B in BRICS, I suppose. And this is an interesting grouping, because really, as everyone should know, it comes from a Goldman Sachs theory, basically, that was put on paper and suddenly became this real organization that is actually working together as some sort of alternative, and now seeking to perhaps create some sort of IMF World Bank alternative at the next summit in Durban next month, where they're going to be meeting to perhaps put together a development bank. Tell us about this and where you see that this might be developing.
Look, this was one of Lula's pet ideas, in fact. This is something that they started discussing already in their first official summit in Yekaterinburg in Russia. Then they were discussing what we should bring Turkey to it as well, because then we would have a Middle Eastern country. And in the end, they brought South Africa because, no, we need somebody in Africa. It's more important than the Middle East. But it's true. This was invented by Jim O'Neill at Goldman Sachs. Jim O'Neill, I read an interview by O'Neill a few days ago at the FT, and he was saying, yes, this was a great idea, but the next thing is the N11, which was coined by O'Neill as well. And that includes an even wackier mixed bag. We have Indonesia, South Korea, Iran, Mexico, you know. It's absolutely... The BRICS... The most important thing for them is, from the beginning, was a counterpower to the Washington consensus. Okay, I think everybody now got the message. But in terms of actual proposals, what do they want in the long run? They want more or less to get rid of the Bretton Woods institutions. And this is something we were talking a while ago. Now, even if you have now Brazilians, Indians, and Chinese very high levels at the IMF, for instance, as technocrats, of course, but they don't decide policy. Policies decide basically by the Treasury, we all know, by the U.S. Treasury Department and by Washington. So the BRICS would like to diversify. How could they do it? One very important point. Let's start accumulating gold so we all have enormous gold reserves. So in the end, if we try to steer the system towards a basket of currencies as reserve currencies, and not only the dollar or the dollar of the euro, we can have the dollar, the euro, but you can also have the yuan, we can have the real, we can have the ruble. So they are all on the same page on this. Second thing, especially from the part of China, the globalization of the yuan, which for them is absolutely essential. And now, for instance, for the past... year or so, over a year, Brazil and China, which are very good trading partners, and now China is the largest trading partner of Brazil. It has always been the United States, not anymore. So now they are trading among themselves in their own currency. So now it's not the dollar anymore, real and yuan. Russia and China, same thing. It's in yuan and ruble. So now I think we are already at the beginning of this convergence between members of huge blocks. Let's trade in our own currencies. And this implies something that's also very important, but is indirectly related to our conversation. The progressive end of the petrodollar. Sooner or later is going to happen. It's going to take a long while. It will be fought tooth and nail by Washington. And this is where Iran, one of the next 11, and 11 enters our conversation as well. The sanctions that are being applied on Iran are forcing Iran to exit the petrodollar for good. They are trading, India is buying Iranian oil in rupees. Until 2 weeks ago, in fact, they were trading with Turkey with the famous gold for gas scheme, and now the new American sanctions are prohibiting that. Who's going to take up the slack? Probably instead of Turkish banks, probably Russian banks, because Russia does a lot of business with both Turkey and Iran as well, and also in terms of energy. So another point, these sanctions are always counterproductive. So the BRICS are trying more or less, not overtly, because they cannot afford to antagonize Washington now, especially now when you have a wounded tiger in Washington. You have to proceed very carefully. But the long-term plan is a slow, gradual, secure exit of Bretton Woods. Maybe this is what they're going to discuss behind closed doors, of course. Us in the media will probably have glimpses of it in the next meeting in Durban.
I think you're right. I think this is at least a window to look into that process that, as we know, is going on right now. And in fact, even on top of all of the bilateral national deals that China is doing right now, even suppliers, even buyers like Tesco in Britain are now actually doing deals denominated in yuan. So it is. They really are moving towards this, and I think it is just a question of time. So let's look at Brazil's place in this, because obviously in Latin America, in the U.S.'s backyard, they are sort of on the front line, I suppose, of any bucking against the Washington consensus. What is Brazil-U.S. relations like at the moment, and how will this affect that, do you think, coming up from here?
Dilma is very, very clever, because Lula, he kept his distance with Washington. And at the same time, he was praised in Wall Street by one of our own because he was not as radical as Hugo Chavez. That was the number one reason, in fact. Dilma, she's an economist. She's very clever. She knows all this. She knows she cannot antagonize Wall Street or Washington by all means. And at the same time, she sinks along Lula's line in terms of closer Latin American integration, or especially South American integration. That's where the Mercosur comes in. Venezuela is now part of the Mercosur. So five countries, almost 80% of South America's economy is part of the Mercosur. So the Mercosur, they need to integrate better with the European Union. This is what they're negotiating. And they want, not only they want, they know they are integrating better with China. Because China is investing, not only Venezuela, China is investing, especially in Brazil and Argentina, the two key countries in South America for the Chinese, in terms of raw materials and natural resources. I would venture to say that in 10 years, 15 years, China will take over a lot of Brazil and Argentina in terms of trade, commerce, and even the financial system. You know, they are looking at South America, okay, we can trust these two countries. They are our partners. They are not a threat. We can do our trade in our national currencies away from U.S. interference completely. And on top of it, in South America, they have oil. Thus, the privileged relationship between China and Chavez. Right now, Chavez is back. He will be running the China-Venezuela energy relationship. Very, very important, because it's over 1 million barrels of oil a day. And in the long run, a lot of Chinese investment in the Orinoco Basin. So sooner or later, the Chinese, they could even forget about South Sudan, about Angola, about parts of Africa, and transfer all their know-how, technology, and investment to the Orinoco Basin. It's a long-term project as well, just like the Brazilian pre-salt project in the coast. Chinese companies will be here. Gazprom will be here. So it's not going to be only big oil in the U.S. and Europe. The Chinese and the Russians will be in Brazil in terms of energy in the long run. So more South American integration, Mercosur, at the same time trying to, I wouldn't say contain Washington, but prevent Washington from doing something foolish like trying to organize another coup in South America. Don't forget that in Latin America, of the three latest U.S.-instigated coups, two were, one in Haiti, one in Honduras. There was a semi-coup in Paraguay. It also worked. The only one that did not work, the only ones that did not work was Venezuela 2002. That was a long time ago. And in Ecuador against Correa a few years ago. And now Correa was re-elected in Ecuador with the overwhelming majority. So this is the most important thing for this axis, which is Mercosur and the countries who form UNASUR, which is a counterpoint to Washington influence in South America. Okay, let's manage the situation. Let's not antagonize the Americas. But at the same time, let's increase our relation, trade, commerce relationship with Europe and especially China.
Pepe, some fascinating stuff, but I'm afraid we are out of time. I have to get going. But I understand that I have pulled you away from some work you're doing on Iran right now at the moment. So I'm sorry to distract you with all of this, but this is a fascinating subject.
Not at all. Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. Well, why don't you tell people what you're working on and where they'll be able to find it?
I was trying to finish a piece for Al Jazeera on the discussions in Almaty next week in Kazakhstan about the Iranian nuclear program. I'm trying to explain the American offers, the Iranian refusals, and why these talks are almost inevitably destined to fail, unfortunately. So it's a huge text, and to put this in a few words is even more complicated.
Yeah.
We will need like hours talking about it.
Yeah, no, unfortunately. Well, maybe we can have that time at some future point. But anyway, I'm always looking forward to your work. So thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, James. Always a pleasure.